Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. 11 minutes after 9 o'clock. Each day we start off with an open discussion of issues and the news and beyond. And this hour we'll start off with our discussion and our Roundtable panel. Joining us this morning, WAMC's Alan Shartok, Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and College of St. Rose Communications Professor Mary Alice Mulgard. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. If you want to weigh in on the conversation and you want to keep it brief but very pithy, give us an email at roundtable@wamc.org. If it's appropriate, old Uncle Alan will read it to roundtable@wamc.org. Alan, you're back from vacation.
I am. We spent a wonderful 9 days in Cartagena, Colombia, mm-hmm. and we really learned a great deal. We like to go to one place and sort of stay there, get to know the place. Colombia, of course, had major problems, lots of drugs.
Yeah.
Things of that kind. A lot of those drug people are in jail now, in the States, by the way. But there's still a lot of police people all around the place and stopping cars and, you know, making sure that... And there are big signs on the side of the road warning you not to use drugs. And very interesting stuff.
I mean, your general impressions?
Loved it.
You did?
Loved it. Yeah, you had the Caribbean. You had on one place. You had the Atlantic. You know, further down, we went to a place called Santa Marta, which was which is up from Cartagena for a couple of days. And wonderful people, smiling, lovely, nice. Not a lot of Spanish spoken, so I don't know about the rest of you.
So you didn't get a chance to use your...
I did. I mean, you know, it's amazing. It comes back.
My trip to Spain.
And all of that. And my college, junior high school, college, and some graduate school Spanish, which I had to do when I did my PhD.
Right.
You know, it's amazing. Some of those idioms come right back into your head.
Well, it's nice to have you back, and you look raring to go, more or less. And so we welcome also Mary Alice Mulgard. Now, I was on vacation, too, but apparently you were on a couple of days.
I was on a couple of days.
And you even came back for this week.
I came back today, and I think I'm scheduled to be on Friday as well.
Well, that's cool. very good to see my old friend.
Designated pinch hitter, I guess.
That's great. And Mike Spain, you're here as well. And
happy to be here.
You look to be in fine fettle, ready for the week.
Have you had your vacation, Mike?
Pardon me?
Have you had your vacation yet?
I've been away this summer. I'm back for the most.
Where did you go?
I went to Portland, Oregon.
Well, that's nice. A nice town.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Nice town. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, we have some news to discuss today. And again, the roundtable at WAMC.org is our email address if you want to weigh in as we roll along here at 9:14 on a Monday morning. The big news, Missouri governor to deploy National Guard to Ferguson. Governor Jay Nixon announced early today that he would deploy the Missouri National Guard to this St. Louis suburb, ratcheting up efforts to quell unrest that has paralyzed the city since an unarmed black teenager was killed by a white police officer. Mr. Nixon said in a statement that he chose to activate the National Guard because of deliberate, coordinated, and intensifying violent acts. The governor's decision comes after the worst night of violence since the unrest began, by the way, quoting here from the New York Times. And... A situation that is boiling over. There was an interesting opinion piece in Time magazine. It was on time.com. Does Time even print an actual...
They do. Newsweek no longer prints, although they were talking about restarting that. But it's Time is both in print and online.
Well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who, as you know, was just one of the greatest basketball players of all time.
Indeed.
And a man with an interesting take on social issues going way back. His opinion piece entitled, "The Coming Race War Won't Be About Race." Ferguson is not just about systemic racism. It's about class warfare and how America's poor are held back, says Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Will the recent rioting in Ferguson, Missouri be a tipping point in the struggle against racial injustice, or will it be a minor footnote in some future grad student's thesis on civil unrest in the early 21st century? And Jabbar says the answer can be found in May of 1970. And, of course, that was the... May 4th, 1970 was the day of Kent State. And his opinion was that after that, the nation's youth were energetically mobilized to end the Vietnam War, racism, sexism, and mindless faith in the political establishment. Alan, what do you think of that?
Well, this is why this story is so important. This is why the story, Mike and Mary Alice, I'm sure you thought about this, shows up on the front page of the New York Times every day in a prominent position. Because it's not that this is happening basically in North St. Louis. It's that the potential for it's happening around the rest of the country is great. And we have seen in this country when cities burn. And so I think everybody is scared to death that is what is going to happen. You know, Jabbar is right and wrong. He's right that it's about poverty and the disparate line between the rich and the poor in this country. But he's wrong in that it doesn't have to do with race, because it very much does.
Well, no, he says it does, but he says he is the first to say this is racism at play. But he says this is a bigger systemic issue. Mary.
Well, you know, you may remember that Martin Luther King said that. The reason that King was despised by so many people who were of a much more conservative nature was that he was not only speaking to people who were of color. He was speaking to everyone, and his big thing was poverty. And so that's why I think, I've always thought that's why King was murdered. And I think to this day that that's why we have this kind of thing going on now, where I think the people who have the most are very worried about this. And I do think that when it gets to be too much, when people give up all hope, when they say we're going to throw Molotov cocktails, and we don't care what happens to us because they know what's going to happen to them. I mean, you know, the full force of the law is going to come down, and it's going to be tremendous repression. It will not be survived by the individuals who are committing these unrest things. So that's what I'm thinking. Rest of the panel, Mary Alice?
Well, I think that the situation overnight definitely got worse. But there were shootings, there were Molotov cocktails being thrown, according to police, and there were incidents that seemed to be completely separate from the relatively peaceful protests that had taken place during the day yesterday. Right? The church groups were all mm-hmm. advising everyone to be calm and to be rational in their discussions. But then something seemed to happen about 8:30 last night that now is pushing the governor's hand. Right? I saw in one report the dreaded phrase "outside agitators."
Yeah.
All right. And so, if that's the case, if people are pulling into Ferguson from St. Louis, which isn't very far away, no. or East St. Louis, which has a decades-long history of racial unrest and problems, then you know, if they have people from the outside of the Ferguson community coming in and taking advantage of the situation, I think that that's probably a pretty solid reason for Jay Nixon to have
the governor,
done the action that he did.
But before Mike goes, it is interesting that the response now is to use, for example, rubber bullets as opposed to regular bullets, which is what, of course, started all this thing, rubber bullets. And now we're seeing these autopsies which are showing that was basically a young man was given seven shots, two of which ended up in the head from the autopsy. So that's you know, that's a change.
Yeah. You wonder if and you're speaking of the Michael Bedden autopsy report, which was one of two autopsies. Now there'll be a third that the federal government has ordered. Mm-hmm. But he found that these were not at close range. I mean, there were no gunpowder burns on the clothing. And it just sounds even more horrific that this man would have been shot so many times and in the head. You know, it's not like we aren't able to know the whole story, but that tells an awfully brutal exchange. Not even an exchange. You
know? The preliminary sketch, the autopsy that I saw this morning, shows the two shots to the head, one at the top of the head, mm-hmm. But four down the arms.
The arms, so like they had tried to
disable. That might be a little bit indicative of a struggle. But, you know, that's certainly not my area of expertise.
No, no, I mean the forensic experts and the eyewitnesses and
But I thought it was interesting that Baden was
connection to him, who was right out of the state police lab here in Albany and New York City's medical examiner for a long time.
And he's coroner the man. To the stars.
He is the man,
he's
right.
The man. Not since Quinn.
Right, that's right.
What was the guy's name?
Quincy. Yeah,
Quincy.
Jack Klugman.
That was TV.
He was the real.
That was, this
Alan
is the real
Alan bears the line between TV and reality. Rifleman is real. And, all right, it's 9:21. We'll take a short break. There was a bit in Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's piece about the overarching issue here that resonates with something Alan has been talking about for years, and I want to discuss that after we take a break. You're listening to The Roundtable.
Support comes from Jenkintown Motors New Paltz, a repair shop for domestic and foreign autos and specializing in Japanese cars for over 30 years. JenkintownMotors.com. The Sembrick, Bolton Landing, New York, presenting the 2014 Menuhin violinist Stephen Wartz, August 23rd at 7:30 p.m., Sembrick.org. And the Opalka Gallery at Sage College of Albany, featuring art exhibits and other cultural events. First this season is ceramic artist Regis Brody, sage.edu/opalka.
The Roundtable on WAMC. 9:22 is the time, and we're discussing the issues in Ferguson here at this early juncture in the panel. And if you want to weigh in, roundtable@wamc.org is the email address. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did an opinion piece at Time Magazine, time.com, and I assume to be in Time Magazine as well. And there was a couple of paragraphs here that really reminded me of something Alan has been talking about for years on this program and others. And I'll read you a couple of paragraphs. This fist-shaking of everyone's racial agenda distracts America from the larger issue that the targets of police overreaction are based less on skin color and more on an even worse affliction, being poor. Of course, to many in America, being a person of color is synonymous with being poor, and being poor is synonymous with being a criminal. Ironically, this misperception is true even among the poor. And that's how the status quo wants it. Now, this is according to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The U.S. Census report finds that 50 million Americans are poor. 50 million voters is a powerful block if they ever get organized in an effort to pursue their economic goals. So it's crucial that those in the wealthiest 1% keep the poor fractured by distracting them with emotional issues like immigration, abortion, and gun control, so they never stop to wonder how they got screwed over for so long. Alan, you have spoken these, not these exact words, but this theme a lot.
Well, we have. But I keep coming back to this separation between being of color and being poor. And I'm saying, you know, you don't see that many people who are not of color reacting the way in these reactions, these public reactions that we're seeing. And I keep thinking, okay, I'm a Jew, and I'm Jewish. And what if the police, for some reason, and in history we have seen it happen, decide, you know, open season on all Jewish people? What am I willing to do to protect my children? And so, when something symbolic like the death of a black man who has, or a black kid who has his hands up in some cases, and is slaughtered, is What am I as a parent doing? We all know what we are as parents. We will do anything for our children, anything to protect them. So I'm thinking that there is more of a racist element here. Although, as I have said before, that's what King latched onto. He was going to make this into a, we're all in this together.
But the point that Abdul-Jabbar makes here is 50 million Americans are poor. Again, I don't know exactly where those numbers come from. He says the U.S. Census report, so I will take it as written. However, his point, and one that you have made many times, is 50 million people is a lot of people, and it's a powerful political block if organized. And his contention is the 1%, whatever you want to call them, those in power, those with money, would prefer that 50 million people not organize.
That's right. They would prefer it. We've heard from Richard, who says, I agree that the state establishment is going to show more and more repression of the underprivileged, people of color in particular. However, just look at how Occupy protests in Berkeley were broken up in 2011. Even our own governor, parenthesis Cuomo, pushed to have protesters dispersed in Albany, leaning heavily on D.A. Soares. And may I add to that, D.A. Soares, a man of great courage, stood up to the governor, which is not easy to do, and said, I'm not going to arrest him and I'm not going to try him. There was a testy relationship, and now we're hearing stories about how the governor's office is getting even with the district attorney's office here. Wasn't there something in the paper about that, Mike? Was there something coming?
Your forward promotion, that's in the next half hour. We only have a couple of minutes, but we will certainly delve into that. Mike, where do you see this going in Ferguson over the next couple of days?
Well, it's getting enormous attention. Not only Al Sharpton, but other civil rights leaders are there. Jesse Jackson has been there. Martin Luther King III has been there. And as it becomes a national story, and it absolutely is and has become that, maybe the attention that it gets will have some good. And that will, I mean, after the 60s, there was an enormous flowing of federal funds into cities and understanding that poverty was a serious problem and that it had to be attacked and you had community development programs. Maybe this comes at a time when Congress has been cutting back on food stamps and cutting back on programs and help the poor. Maybe this will change the tide. Hopefully that'll be the positive outcome. But if there's violence, it really does diminish the ability of this to be seen as something that is a national problem that has to be addressed. It'll become more of a, let's blame the bad guys on this.
I actually thought, Mike, that you were going to say something else. I think at a time when the House of Representatives is in the hands of the conservative Republicans who were doing exactly what you were saying in terms of cutting back on resources to the poor. And now a very good chance that the United States Senate is going to go Republican in the same way. You really have a situation where who's going to put the salve on this thing so that we have less tension here. I think this is a very dangerous time.
I think this is going to be somewhat what Abdul-Jabbar said in the opening of his piece, the footnote to history.
Okay.
I don't think that this is going to have a long-lasting permanent effect. I think that this is similar to the other example he used that didn't get into part of the conversation was right after the Kent State shootings, just a few days later,
yep.
There were shootings at Jackson State in South Carolina.
Correct.
Right, and nobody other than maybe people like us and a few other historians remember that thing even occurred.
Okay, so you answered the question I was about to ask for our final 30 seconds. Alan.
Yes.
Is this, what is going on today in Missouri, capable of becoming a catalyst that Kent State was?
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And I think I was trying to project by saying when you start thinking about people who throw away the rest of their lives because they know there are going to be major consequences from acting out, from throwing a Molotov cocktail, from getting in the way of a tank or doing any of those things, that's when it gets very dangerous for the establishment.
Okay, it could be, but will it?
No.
Mike Spain.
Well, I think Jabbar fears that it will not because it will be viewed as just racial unrest when it's not a broader thing like haves and have-nots.
Okay.
And that's where...
So you won't predict?
No. I mean, it would need a broader perspective before be seen as a broader issue for it to have that lasting
impact. It's going to be repression.
Okay.
That's what it's going to be.
We would love to hear from you. The email address here is roundtable@wamc.org. Keep them brief. roundtable@wamc.org. We will take a break for news, and then we'll be back with Mr. Perry and Mr. Cuomo and lots of interesting stuff. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Nice work if you can get it. Yes, it's a story of my life here in radio. 9:36 on a Monday morning. It's the Roundtable, and the first hour we devote to the Roundtable panel. Today on the show, it's Mike Spain of the Times Union, Mary Alice Mulgard, who is you're a communications professor?
Assistant professor.
Yes, I only know from our professional workings in TV and such, but you're a full-fledged professor. Do you wear glasses when you're a professor?
Yeah, all the time, see?
Sunglasses, yeah. No less.
She's a living legend among journalists in the Albany area. Everybody loves her.
And so much fun to work with. Yeah. And Alan Shartok, also great fun to work with, is here. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. And if you want to email us, it's roundtable@wamc.org.
We encourage it, as a matter of fact.
In fact, we do.
Yeah, I think everybody's on vacation. Usually we, you know, the same, at least the same six guys writing. But they're not today.
Maybe they're so enthralled by the conversation they've been unable to hit the keyboard.
No, they're probably on vacation up in Maine.
That's a good point. Oh, love Maine. Love Vermont, too. Drove through Vermont on our vacation. So we didn't take the highways.
Yeah.
Because it's too crowded in the summer.
And there are tolls.
And we went right across Vermont, which I think is the most picturesque drive in the entire country. Fabulous. And New Hampshire, good, too.
Well, and what's so interesting to me, always has been, is there's two states right next to each other. One is ultimately a conservative state, New Hampshire, and Vermont is quite open in its thinking.
Mm-hmm. Libertarian, kind of.
You think so?
Yeah. I think if you go so far left, then you come around to the right.
Really?
Yes.
On the great circle of life?
On the great wheel of life, indeed. All right, let's move on here. Okay, so, you know, I was up at the beach most of the time, and I missed a lot of the news. But
see any whales?
That wasn't a shot, right?
What?
Okay.
Excuse me.
All right.
What do you mean a shot?
No, the way you said it, we saw no
whale. Okay, I'm going to give you an answer.
It was a shot. Right. Dirty run. So nice to be back.
It was a shot.
Okay, so one thing I could not avoid up there was the story with Rick Perry, and reading up on it last night, fascinating stuff. And this one is, this is from, I believe, the Washington Post. Yes, Rick Perry claims indictment part of a larger rule of law problem. Quoting here, Texas Governor Rick Perry insisted Sunday that a grand jury indictment alleging he abused his office and tried to coerce an elected official was unjustified, pointing to support he has received from political leaders to bolster his claim. In his first national television interview since the indictment was announced Friday, Perry defended his decision to veto funding for a state anti-corruption unit after a district attorney refused to resign, even as he publicly asked her to do so. He also claimed the indictment was part of a larger rule of law problem in government. At issue is Perry's decision to veto $7.5 million in funding for an anti-corruption unit that is part of the Travis County District Attorney's Office. The district attorney from Travis County, Rosemary Lemberg, was asked to step down after she had a drunken driving arrest, and Perry made good on his threat to withhold the money after she didn't do so. So what do we make of this? Politics at play?
Well, of course.
Standard operating procedure?
Well, of course. Look, she is a Democrat. She got caught drunk driving.
Three times the legal limit.
Yeah, she got caught drunk driving.
And there was video.
And so, look, she didn't do good and left herself vulnerable. On the other hand, she's a Democrat. He's a Republican. He sees an opportunity, and he goes after her. But then you have to sort out the idea that this is an anti-corruption unit that he is not giving the money to. And that, of course, is what is raising an awful lot of eyebrows. Now, in the same way we talked about the replication effect, think about this. You have a super manager like Andrew Cuomo, who, from everything we know, is a guy who, you know, likes to control everything from the Moreland Ag Commission to other things. A big story out on that this morning. And if in fact you're going to start indicting people for making demands like you should resign because you were caught drunk driving, I don't know if it has legs. I would be very, very surprised if this went anywhere.
I cannot see it going anywhere. When the story broke, I started looking for all the stories I could find on it. You know, I went to the Houston Chronicle. I read the New York Times story to see if they had a different explanation, and it's just difficult to understand. I mean, if somebody's behavior, a public official's behavior, especially a prosecutor's behavior, is so compromised by a blatant driving while intoxicated address where she, you know, was clearly having way over the legal limit, that kind of behavior can compromise that kind of a public official's ability to do their job. And it, you know, you could debate whether or not they should be forgiven and given another chance, but they're adversaries. And he called for her resignation, which happens all the time.
Somebody,
Right. People misbehave and people ask them.
Yeah, I think he saw an opportunity to help his own image. Obviously, he imploded during the last presidential run. And then this prosecutor is from Travis County, which is Austin. Right, and Austin is
like
clearly
Vermont.
He's like Vermont, exactly.
People's
you know, the
Republic
the
of
much more liberal side of Texas politics.
The Burlington of Texas.
Yeah. So maybe he saw this as an opportunity to help himself by taking a local angle, a local story, and just putting it in a little bit more national perspective.
Well, by way
it
of
doesn't help him to be seen in handcuffs, believe me.
Right, but by way of explanation, the grand jury alleged that he overstepped the bounds of legality by withdrawing funding to force a resignation of a public official, for which he did not have the appointment power to.
Right, that's the coercion.
Well, Governor Cuomo hasn't been exactly nice to D.A. Soares ever since the district attorney.
But he never funded an anti-corruption unit in Albany County to begin with that he could withdraw the funding from. I mean, that's the difference
here. There's a story coming.
There is a story coming, and let's just do one more note on this. And this is, again, quoting from the Los Angeles Times. Critics of Perry note that at the time the funding for Lemberg's office was cut, its public corruption unit was investigating one of the governor's pet projects, the Cancer Prevention and Research Institute of Texas. Questions have surfaced regarding the institute's funding and the role of some of Perry's political allies.
Uh-huh.
So,
the plot thickens.
Whether that has legs or not, Alan, you brought up a point. It's not necessarily good for Perry's image to be seen in handcuffs, but...
Or with a mugshot.
Going to Mary Alice's point, if he was doing it to make a point and is ultimately exonerated or it's thrown out saying you have no business making this case against Perry, doesn't that help him?
Oh, I think it helps him. I think it's a good move on his part. I don't think he did anything wrong here from the political standpoint.
Even from the legal standpoint, political standpoint.
Yeah, the soundbite aspect of it is the Democrats in Austin went after him. It was thrown out. It's just another win for Perry, you know, and part of his comeback. But the nuances and more complicated is that this was he was defunding an agency that was going after him. And that's the optics of that are
pretty bad. It
doesn't
help anybody, I think. Yeah. That'd be my take on it.
Okay, now it's time to push on to the next bit here. And this is from the Albany Times Union, or just the Times Union, but not the Knickerbocker News. Trip just
not
a small
1988. Not
trip
since.
Just a small respite. This is by Matthew Hamilton. It was as if Governor Andrew Cuomo had never left New York. Now he's back from Israel. Mike, fill us in.
Well, Matt's story today just sort of looks at how, right away, the questions that were sort of put on the shelf while the governor was visiting Israel are back. And those are questions about the Moreland Act Commission. While he was in Israel, all the questions were about the propriety of that and whether that was a political trip and who was going to pay for it. It turned out his campaign paid for it, so I guess it was a political trip. And lots of New York politicians go to Israel, and that was the story last week. We talked about it here.
Mm-hmm.
But this week, according to Matt's story, the governor was on a phone interview with Fox News, and the question came up about the Moreland Act Commission, and it sounds like it's going to come back up every place that he goes. Whether it gets any traction?
Well, it'll get a lot of traction if Preet Bharara does something. I mean, if he really issues some kind of report and alleges wrongdoing, or if somebody on the Cuomo staff is indicted, you better believe it's going to get a lot more traction than it has now. Otherwise, it goes away.
Right. And the real the political aspect of it right now is his own primary, Democratic primary for governor, where Zephyr Teachout, a law professor from Fordham University, is challenging him. And if she stays on the ballot, and she may not because the Cuomo campaign is challenging a court ruling that kept her on the ballot last week. But if she stays on the ballot, it could give people who want to express their opposition to Cuomo a chance to express that and embarrass him.
And the interesting thing is she stays on the ballot. It's too late to print the ballots again, right? I think that's what happened. She stays on the ballot.
Mm.
And she sat here one day, and Tim Wu, who was running for lieutenant governor with her on the same ticket, was sitting next to her. And I said, no, this is a one-on-one conversation, me and you, I said to him. So he made a face. He said, okay, then I'm not staying here. I have an important interview with the Washington Post. He charged out of here, went over there. She said, you know, he's going to win because, you know, nobody really knows the Hochul and the rest of it. He's going to win. I said, he's not going to win. Well, which may prove to be one of those stupid things I said at some point, and I'll be held responsible for it.
Well, it's which side, the Cuomo people or the people opposed to Cuomo in the Democratic Party, are able to mobilize their base and get out the vote. And I bet the Cuomo people will be getting the vote out. I'll bet the primary will not surprise us.
Oh, you mean will Teachout win? No.
Oh, no, not. I mean, but she'd have to. It's the percentage points. If she gets somewhere in the 40s and he gets something below
40s.
60.
I think if she gets 20, it's going to be seen as huge. Yeah.
Well, right. she's ticked we'll up a few points in the polling that's been done just in this last week. She has ticked up a little bit, and I think that there's at least interest in her. Reality is not a snowball's chance, but... At least it's an interesting venture.
Is it still too early to get any polling on a possible uptick for the governor based on this trip to Israel, which looks to me, now again, I've been away all week, looks to me more focused on 2016 than the coming months?
Well, it doesn't hurt him in New York. New York has the second largest Jewish population in the world after Israel. I mean, you know, and we all know, and I've said it 1,000 times, that there's tribal politics. We all have senses of what's happening to our particular group. And so I thought it was a brilliant move on his part. He did the right thing. I can't get inside his brain. I don't know why he did it. But, you know, one could just assume that it was political.
It can't hurt him.
No. It's like chicken soup.
It's like chicken soup. The email address here is also a soothing tonic for us. roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. If you want to weigh in on anything you've heard or not heard, we you know, if it's not too long, if it's not a manifesto, Alan will read it. Right?
Yeah,
right,
no, if it's not a manifesto.
Let's take a break. We'll be back on the roundtable.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. The Urgent Care Centers of Middletown Medical, providing walk-in medical care with no appointment, daytime, evening, and weekend hours in Middletown, Ellenville, and now in Chester. MiddletownMedical.com. And Bistro 63 at the Monkey Bar, downtown Amherst, offering casual lunches and dinners featuring steak, seafood, cocktails, and wines using local organic products, banquet facilities, and patio dining. Bistro63.com.
The Roundtable on WAMC. 10 minutes before 10 o'clock. Ray Graff here for Joe Donahue, Alan Shartok, Mike Spain, and Mary Alice Mulgar. The email address is roundtable@wamc.org. And Alan, we have some.
Yes. Jay says, this unit went after Tom DeLay, and the initial response was much like yours. This is all political and won't hurt DeLay. Where is Tom DeLay now, having coffee with Eric Cantor?
Well played there,
that's
sir.
That's what he said. Okay, and I'm having trouble here. Okay, and John says, are you sure of what you said on Roundtable this morning? Why Rick Perry will be convicted, and he sends us an article, but we never read whole articles.
No, we can't do that.
We don't do that, yeah. And then Lee says, gang, I'm a longtime WNC supporter. One of the things that concerns me is your lack of representation among your group, and particularly your lack of representation of people of color as members consistently of your round table. I believe this leads to a more narrow perspective and possibly a lack of in-depth conversation with regards to issues concerning class, race, and poverty. What will you do, if anything, to address this apparent opportunity for a broader discourse? And that's from Lee. And then... And Vane says, nothing justifies violence against anonymous neighbors, people, stores, neighborhoods during a protest. Accidental breaking of a window or two is understandable. Protesters looting and burning makes no sense. The victims of this are neighbors. Whatever happened to sit-ins? Let the police arrest nonviolent protesters. That'll show the perpetrators, the police or authorities. if that's what you want to do or to believe, and the news media what it's all about, if the mayor simply had sent no police to the protests and or had simply let the protests go beyond dusk, midnight, whatever, what would have been the what would the outcome have been? Police said National Guard do not, quote, restore police. Police and National Guard do not, quote, restore peace and order with armor and tear gas. And then let's see here. No, that takes us to other places, so we don't read it.
Spam?
No. In other words, there are people who continually
give
send
us all
in
the
a
topics.
Thing, and
yep.
then send us to the Washington Post for another thing. We're not obviously going to read that.
No.
Okay. Scott says this: the unfortunate death in Ferguson does not justify looting, gas bomb, and rock throwing, burning buildings, etc. It is a distraction from the shootings of from the shooting and what really happened. I have not heard Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton speaking against these bad acts. Same goes for the good citizens, in quotes, of Ferguson. These activities are unacceptable and distracting from what really happened. Why is there silence before one of these things happen and then a big outcry after? The good people need to take care of their kids and clean up their neighborhoods, root out the thugs in advance. And that is from Nick. And then from Thomas, who says, says too much, and just too long.
We can't do that.
Yeah,
that's all right.
Okay, and Michael says, is it relevant here that the kid was a criminal and caught in the act of video, on video before his confrontation with the officer? That was from Michael. And Charles says, I was still waiting for the police report, still waiting for a video from the patrol car. Even if it shows nothing, the audio from the car should have the original confrontation. What do we get? A news conference that accuses the victim of stealing, which has nothing at all to do about the incident that occurred to me. Ferguson puts the sour in Missouri. Missouri, get it?
Right.
Okay, and then I think something came in here, yeah.
Oh, boy.
No, that's another
one. All right,
one
so us. Thank yes. you. Roundtable at WAMC.org is the email address. Wanted to get this in, and we only have about 4 minutes here, and I apologize, Mary Alice, but this is one that you found interesting, and I find very interesting. And this is actually from The Guardian, but I believe the New York Times was the original source. James Risen calls Obama greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation. The New York Times investigative reporter James Risen has exhausted his legal avenues to avoid prison under the Espionage Act. The New York Times reporter, who faces jail over his refusal to reveal a source and testify against a former CIA agent accused of leaking secrets, has called President Obama the greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation. He faces jail time because he wouldn't give up the sources on a story that was about a botched intelligence operation that ended up spilling nuclear secrets to Iran. Mary Alice, I'll give you first crack at this.
All right. Well, I think Risen, I don't know if he's going to become the martyr on the altar of press freedom or not, but he's just one more in a long line of reporters who refuse to give up their confidential sources. And the administration, whether it's the Obama administration or any other, doesn't have the right to compel a reporter to do that. And I think that after the New York Times situation before, there was an opportunity for President Obama to push forward a national shield law that would have eliminated some of this difficulty and failed to do so. I don't think I would go so far as to say, the greatest threat to press freedom of all time.
Who was?
Richard Nixon.
Alan?
Well, Richard Nixon certainly didn't like the press, followed closely by psychiatrists who
That's
didn't
true.
Like either. and so, look, you get into public office and the press gets on you. Sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly. There's a huge piece in the New York POST, a name I never uttered, this morning about how Hillary demands to be treated as a diva when she goes to on her speaking trips. And the way the plane has to be configured and the place she has to. So the press can really agitate and can get you. But I do didn't I remember, Mary Alice, maybe you can confirm this, or Mike, that the Attorney General Holder said nobody was going to jail over this.
Right. He made a point to say that the Justice Department was not going to prosecute leaks, you know, or people accused of leaking to the press, or it wasn't going to go after reporters to reveal their sources. And yet they're pressing this one particular case. It's a case against a former CIA employee who is believed to have been the source.
They want to make an example of
him. Right, and they want to make an example of this guy.
Of the source.
The CIA guy. And they're using Risen's, you know, the pressure on Risen to perhaps push this guy into copping a plea rather than going to trial. They don't want it to go to trial, and that's what's at stake.
Or they want him, the source, to self-identify, as happened with the Judith Miller case, you know.
And that kept her out of jail.
And she had permission, right? She was given permission by the source.
Eventually, after an extended period of time.
Yeah. Well, Mike, how do you balance, on the one hand, Holder saying, journalists aren't going to jail. On the other hand, this journalist might be in the slammer in 3 weeks.
It sounds like he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth.
Well,
here.
Al D'Amato put it best.
Yeah.
When asked whether he had changed his mind about something. And he said, in classic D'Amato style, that was then and this is now.
This is now, yeah. Holder, though, has a habit of doing that. He'll say one thing for one particular audience and something for another. But in this case, I thought, too, Risen, instead of doing a piece himself, uses Maureen Dowd as his mouthpiece.
She interviewed him, and this was basically, this article here came from her column on Sunday, which was extraordinarily sympathetic to him and how it's going to personally affect him. And, you know, and while still making the case that this is just, seems like an extraordinary injustice.
Alas, we are out of time.
No.
Yes, I'm sorry, but we'll be back. Alan Shartok, thank you. Mary Alice Malgard, thank you. Mike Spain of the Times Union, thank you. I'm Ray Graff, in for Joe Donahue. If you want to weigh in, the email address, as ever, roundtable@wamc.org. Back with a thrilling hour two coming up.
Was that a shot when you said weigh in?
Hey.